an artist may only play 20, 30 or 40 raga all his life. But even one single raga, one cannot finish it. There's always something new that happens in his mind and he discovers. So it is like, you know, never ending.
The voice of India's most celebrated musician and composer, and my guest on Mainstream Asia Tonight, Ravi Shankar. Ravi Shankar, who's 60 this year, was born in 1920, and from his formative years he began studying the sitar, that exquisite stringed instrument that takes a lifetime to master, and which for centuries has expressed the song of India itself. As one celebrated musician once said, the sitar is the only musical instrument with a soul. Of all the many great classical musicians who came out of India and widened the West's knowledge and appreciation of Indian music, none quite caught the imagination of young people in the West like Shankar. He shot to prominence and international fame in the early 60s through his association with, among others, the Beatles. Beatle George Harrison was his pupil. The 60s was also the era when India's culture had a profound effect on Western popular music. Western jazz, pop, cinema, TV, and classical music frequently featured the sitar, the tambura, and the tabla. Ravi Shankar became a cult figure during the youth explosion, and as a result, even now, he retains a very youthful following. Well, last Sunday, he jetted into Holland for a sellout concert in my town, Utrecht. And just before he went on stage, I managed to sit with the maestro and discuss various aspects of his life, his art, and his aspirations. And tonight, for the entire duration of this program, I'd like to share that conversation with you, interjected naturally with the brilliant music that has made Ravi Shankar a legend in his lifetime. First question I want to put to you is, many people know that you spend a lot of your time of the year touring around the world giving concerts, but where in fact are you now presently based? Where in fact would you call home?
Varanasi, which is also known as Benares in India.
Are you teaching there at all? Do you have a school there?
No, I don't have a school as such, but we are starting an institution. We call it RIMPA. RIMPA means a research institute for music and performing arts. And we haven't started functioning as an institution yet, but we have started functioning as propagating festivals, music circles, etc.
Do you feel that in the past few years you have spent perhaps more time outside of India than you would have liked to have spent?
Yeah, actually that's true. But I was caught into this responsibility of, you know, being here because there were two currents, you know. One was an actual interest in music, the other was like a vogue, you know. And the whole thing started with in 65, 66, as you know, it's an old story. And then the whole thing was mixed up with drug culture, hippies and all that. So I was trying to, you know, segregate and put our music in the right place, which it deserves.
Talking about that, Master, it's often said that Western technology has had a profound influence on Indian music in this particular last 20 years or so. Now, Indian classical music, as I read it, was traditionally performed in a very intimate atmosphere before a select and musically educated group of listeners. Now you are obliged to play for audiences that number thousands. Do you feel that this climate and this way of presenting the classical music of India has any way diminished the music?
You are right in saying that our music is very much sort of fitted for an intimate gathering, because it is a very individual sort of interpretation, and it needs a lot of atmosphere, which is only possible when there's a small gathering of understanding listeners. And that's why our music is really at its best when we perform for rather intimate music circles. But how can you imprison music now, because the whole world is changing? The mass before never had a chance to listen to the music. It was in the royal courts and at the houses of the aristocrats. That's where it was closeted, which was good. But on the other hand, as the whole thing has changed, you see, we don't have royalties, maharajas and nawabs and patrons. So the common people are the people who are encouraging the music. So it has to have a larger hall. One can't change it. So one has to adjust as much as possible. But it doesn't mean that you spoil it. We are really having performances in large auditoriums in India, and still having the atmosphere, very beautiful atmosphere.
But I would imagine that the performances that you give in India are very different from the ones that you would get here in the West, because I would imagine that this music is, of course, a part of the heritage and the culture of an Indian listener. He would perhaps grasp some of the subtle and fine points of a raga. But when performing it, let's say, here in Utrecht, as you are going to do tonight, do you think that really the audience out there will be able to appreciate the subtleness and the finer points of Indian music?
Well, not the whole audience, that's true. But in Holland especially, it's very special, I find, especially Amsterdam area, because number of reasons and number of people who have been encouraging music, including my student Jamaluddin Bhartia, who has got a school here, and also Felix Lamsverde, who has done it for many years, you know. And such people have created a small group of, it may not be thousands, but it may be, say, 100 or 200 people, or maybe a couple of hundred people who are very much familiar with our music, sound of it, and they can also understand quite well technically. But it doesn't matter, in the sense, if one performs with, sincerity, and if the artist has got that power to communicate through his music, it does travel even if you don't understand technically.
Thank you.
This next question I put to you, Maestro, you may consider perhaps as old hat, because I would imagine you've been asked this for a decade or more, but I want to put it to you again because there's a point I want to make. You, more than anyone else, spearheaded Western awareness in India's musical heritage, and a decade ago, a rich variety of musicians came out of India to the West, and they were received with overwhelming enthusiasm. Now, classical musicians like, let's say, Yehudi Menuhin, a friend of yours, and then pop stars like the Beatles hitched on to you and attempted to incorporate the sound of the sitar into the Western musical forms. Yet, within a decade, the mass Western involvement with Indian music seems to have been over. Now, how do you account for that?
That's very simple. I mean, I won't say the classical side of it, because Menuhin or Rampal or Zubin Mehta or people like this, we are still working together. They haven't changed. You see, their interest has been equally then and now. But in the pop scene, in the younger generation, it came like a wave, you know, along with some Beatles and other pop stars trying to use the sound of sitar, or trying to take something from our music, you see. And particularly, I was thrown into this situation more than anyone else because George Harrison became my student, you see. So that's how it happened. And because at that time, all the young people immediately took to this Indian music, Indian religion, Indian perfume, Indian incense, Indian kurtas, you know, cloths, and Tantra, Kama Sutra, and everything, they all got mixed up, you see. And it was with that spirit, because they were not matured enough. Most of them, they took it as a fashion. And it lasted quite long. I was surprised, because usually things like this last only 6 months or 1 year, but whereas the whole Indian scene lasted almost 4 or 5 years. Mm. Then gradually it came down. But you have to realize, like you are going to see the audience tonight, or you'll see in Paris or London or anywhere outside India. Out of this, I would say millions, not hundreds of thousands, but millions of young people all around the world, believe me, maybe 5%. But this small group of people, they have remained, and they are much better now, and because they are not just coming to our music along with drugs and, you know, like a fashion, but they have a genuine love and understanding. And today I feel our audience is much better, because it is again small but more understanding and more appreciative.
Chakra, Anahata Chakra.
as a master of your instrument, the sitar, and having spent, my goodness, all your lifetime, I should think, learning the techniques and the whole sort of history of it and the feeling that goes with it. It's not just learning an instrument, it's learning a tradition that goes back thousands of years. Would you say that there is an end point to learning when it comes to playing this instrument?
Oh, not at all. I have, particularly in our music, because even for that matter, I'm sure it is same thing in Western music, but at least in Western music, what you call repertoire. You have such and such composition. You have hundreds of compositions, starting from solo, sonatas, this, that, symphony music. So there's at least, you can catalog them, right? So many things an artist can play or does play or perform. But with us, that's not the case. We can take the one raga only. Forget 16,000 and some odd ragas that there are supposed to be. An artist may only play 20, 30 or 40 raga all his life. But even one single raga, one cannot finish it. There's always something new that happens in his mind and he discovers. So it is like, you know, never ending.
Having got onto the question of the raga and talking about it, the word raga is defined as music with color, mood, and exquisite variation. That's what I read in my dictionary. But how would you, as the master, define it? Is there a simple way of defining it?
Well, it's the most difficult thing to explain to a Westerner or people who do not know raga, to explain what a raga is. I always start by saying what a raga is not. That's the easiest way, perhaps. It's not a scale. Raga is not just merely a melody. Raga is not a song or a key or a mode. But it is nearest to a mode. A modal structure, like you have modal music in Middle East, in Far East, many places. But raga is absolutely unique to India. Raga is something which it is based on scale. It has got its own ascending, descending structure. It has got some motif, main motif, by which you can recognize a raga. Sometimes it's five notes, sometimes six notes, sometimes seven notes, sometimes mixed, you know, ascending five, descending six, and goes on, permutation and combination. But even then, after all that, you can play on a piano keyboard, but it won't be a raga. It will, what we call it, will be like a skeleton of a raga. To put real life in a raga needs many years of, first of learning, then learning the secrets of giving that life to the raga from the guru that you have to learn. And then it needs individual work for a long time. To make the raga alive, to make the raga breathe, you know, that's what we think of a raga.
Finally, Maestro, in a few minutes from now, you'll be going on stage and expressing all these feelings that you've expressed to me in your music. I want to ask one question. I'm sure there are many people who will be curious about it. We all know that Indian classical music has strong ties with Indian religion, with Hinduism. I've often wondered if you prepare yourself for a performance in a particular way, just moments before you go on stage, as you have the moments now before you go on. Is there any particular duty or thing you do?
Well, personally, I am, and like many musicians are, you know, in India, the Indian music is performed by Hindu musicians as well as Muslim musicians. So everybody, you know, prays or meditates in his own particular manner. I, being a Hindu Brahmin, I have had my own religious trainings from my childhood, and I have, apart from my musical guru, I had spiritual guru also. So, you know, it's very natural for me to do yogic meditation and everything, which I do every day. But before the performance, it is a very special and tense moment. You know, I like to concentrate and, you know, think of my guru, think of certain deities that I worship. And, you know, it's like gathering spiritual strength and power through that and some mantras that we utter in our mind. So all this, you know, add to the music. It's not just the music, but it is all sort of, to me, it's everything together. Thank you.
Man who rightly deserves every superlative in the book, Ravi Shankar, my special guest on tonight's Mainstream Asia. And that last piece of music which you just heard was the finale from his famous composition, the Concerto for Sitar, performed with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. Now, looking ahead to next Friday, tune in and you'll meet the Indian film director, producer and writer who's currently winning loud hurrahs for his first feature film, which he made in Europe and exported to India. His name is Vinod Pandey, and I'll also be featuring two of the hit songs from his film El Barbier. And next Friday will also be my last show before I go on a month's vacation, which means that Mainstream Asia takes a four-week break. However, in the holiday period, you can hear our magazine show, 7 Days, with Roger Broadbent, which will feature special Asian reports and interviews. More about that next Friday. Till then, from me, Pete Myers, a happy weekend, let's hear from you, and good night, Asia.